outmaneuvering Democrats, confirming conservative judges were McConnell's specialties. Brett Kavanaugh would be his crowning achievement.
It's moving the court to a really very, very conservative court.
The U.S. Supreme Court and partisan politics are back in the news this week, not for something the court did, but for something it didn't do. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney. It declined to consider two challenges to Roe v. Wade, which gave every woman a constitutional right to abortion in 1972. President Trump's latest appointment, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, has created expectations. He's been promoted as the final step in almost 50 years of effort to produce a court willing to overturn Roe v. Wade. No explanation was given for this week's refusal to take up the issue, and it's likely just a delay. But it's an opportunity to take a look at the court, its tremendous power over the lives of Americans, and the role of politics in transforming the court's makeup from one time to another. The latest Frontline documentary on PBS is called Supreme Revenge, and the title is apt. Senate confirmation of recent nominees have not been orderly processes, but all-out political campaigns. Michael Kirk is the director of Supreme Revenge. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Warren. It's great to be talking to you.
Let's go to the title. Who's getting revenge on who?
Well, I think it's a kind of a two-part revenge, but it's young first-term Mitch McConnell who watches Robert Bork get taken down by the Democrats in an ugly, nationally televised moment, who sort of shakes his fist at the Democrats, goes to the floor, you know, a really a unique thing for a first-termer to do, and sort of says, okay, you guys, this is war. I'm going to come back, and someday when you really want something, I'm going to deny it. Of course, we'll probably talk about what that is at one moment. And in another moment, in a sort of second tier of revenge, you have the Brett Kavanaugh moments right around those hearings where the clock was ticking on McConnell leading up to the midterm elections, and he had to get him confirmed and did what he had to do that.
So you're covering a lot of ground. Let's go back to Robert Bork. Who was he? Who appointed him to what? And under what circumstances was he taken down?
So Robert Bork in the 1980s and in the 70s was, you know, probably the exemplar of ultra conservatism in the country at a time when the Supreme Court was moving into, you know, personal privacy issues, Brown v. Board of Education in the 50s, all the way along up until Reagan becomes president. The Democrats had been pretty happy with what was happening with the Supreme Court. It's at the moment that Reagan realizes that almost nothing that he really wanted to happen legislatively was going to happen, but he did have the court, and in those last 10 months decided that Robert Bork, he was going to put Bork on the court. It was going to change the direction of the Supreme Court for a generation, and because Bork was that guy, he was going to take on abortion, he was going to take on civil rights, and he also knew, Reagan, that at Mies, Californians, both of them, that they would that they were going to be tweaking the Democrats in a very substantial way by putting Bork on the court. So when Bork is announced by Reagan, Ted Kennedy goes to the floor of the United States Senate and delivers one of his most famous speeches, which is called Robert Bork's America. And that is really the striking of the match that starts a fire of political sort of politics of destruction advise and consent process that we see happen and culminate in what happened with Brett Kavanaugh.
So you started out with Ronald Reagan. Let's flash forward for a moment, because you have a very interesting interview with one of the people who has worked closely with Donald Trump. And Steve Bannon says that he thinks that one of the things that got Trump elected, and that means got him the financial support particularly that he needed, was a list that was given to him by the Federalist Society. What's that, and how did it play a role in the campaign?
So this is the other central figure in this drama besides Mitch McConnell are the members of the Federalist Society. They were, in the beginning, just a lot of students at law schools, liberal law schools, Stanford, Harvard, University of Chicago, and Yale. And they were the kind of disgruntled conservatives in the 70s and 80s who said, we really need an affinity. We need people to talk to. We'd really like to, we feel a fish out of water here. Antonin Scalia was their advisor in Chicago, and Bork was their advisor at Yale. And when Bork goes down in flames, suddenly, a lot of what Jane Mayer, the author of the book Dark Money, would call dark money starts to come to this group of students and professors and the Olin Foundation and others. They create a group that will grow in the post-Bork years and decades later into a group that starts with just a few dozen students, Bork and Scalia, and becomes the force that it is today, 60,000 members. Almost every federal judge that's been appointed in the McConnell-Trump era is a Federalist Society nominee, blessed by the Society. It's a job fair, it's a judge training ground, and it's also a huge political force in Washington, especially since Mitch McConnell has become the leader of the Senate and Donald Trump has become the president. So that force of conservative Republicans who also delivered Clarence Thomas to replace Thurgood Marshall, that force, the Federalist Society, gets together with McConnell, a name that you'll recognize, Don McGahn, a Federalist Society member, also working at the time on the campaign for Donald Trump. And they sit down with Trump, who Lindsey Graham tells us in our film, nobody knew in the Republican Party who Donald Trump was in terms of his relationship to conservative causes or ideals, or even if he was a Republican.
He may not have known himself.
Well, exactly. That may be absolutely positive, positively true. So what happens? Trump takes a meeting at Jones Day, a very conservative law firm, Federalist Society-dominated law firm in Washington, D.C., takes a meeting there with the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society and Don McGahn, and he asks for a list of names of people who would prove to conservatives in America that he was one of them. They deliver the list. He waves it around for a few days, and it's enough, according to Steve Bannon, for him to get his sort of bona fides all signed up, and he's now a conservative exemplar.
Worth pointing out that five members of the current U.S. Supreme Court are members of the Federalist Society. But where does the money come from? There's a lot of money involved in all of this. Among those involved, Leonard Leo, who is a vice president of the organization. And what interests care enough to provide money to senators according to how they vote on judicial nominees?
Well, in the most general terms, it's corporate America. It's also philanthropic foundations like Olin and others, Bradley, that have awash in money designed for politics and for fostering their goals and ideals in the political realm. A lot of it has to do with business and business interests and lack of regulation, and also just creating an atmosphere that fits conservative ideals in the country. How much money? Tens of millions of dollars. Their budget last year. And there's a lot of kind of money that's also in kind of I won't say really hidden places, but it's not necessarily available to the rest of us to find. But it's the obvious number, the one you can actually get is $26 million, and that started with $70,000 back when Bork goes down, and now here we are with the Federalist Society awash in lots of money.
You talk to a lot of people, including senators as well as others who aren't necessarily casting votes. What are the most interesting things that you found as you were pursuing this subject?
I think the most important thing that just strikes me, Warren, after all these, I usually do 30 or 40 interviews for a film, and they're usually about a couple of hours, and we put them all up on the web so people can read them and see whether it's fake news we're rolling out for people. But and you can see every word, and you can see the ones that are selected for the film and the ones that aren't, and everything's in context. So I spend a lot of time talking to people, and one of the things that struck me early and often in the process of interviewing these people was, why have the Democrats not created a Federalist Society of their own? Why do the Democrats not have the forceful arguments and attraction to trying to push candidates and their candidates who care about Democratic goals and progressive ideas as strongly as clearly the Republicans do? And the answers to that question are the ones that, you know, leave you thinking, this is why we are where we are now, which is a Mitch McConnell Federalist Society Supreme Court with five strong conservatives, Federalist Society blessed conservatives, and a president who, if he's reelected, has an opportunity clearly to fill at least two more vacancies if the Republicans hold the Senate. So the thing that I was interested in is, where have the Democrats been? And even the Democrats I talked to were just shaking their heads and saying, we have just really blown it. We had it too easy during the Warren Court and the Berger Court, and all the things seemed to be coming our way, and we cared about, and even Obama, Professor Larry Tribe from Harvard Law School told me that, you know, he had worked for Obama, and that he would go to Obama and say, you really must pay attention to the court. And Obama would say, I have, you know, dramatic, urgent needs for the American people, and I cannot deal with what's in the future with a court. I just can't give my political capital to that. I need to get health care, and I need to get a financial crisis solved. And, you know, fair enough, but it is striking that McConnell and the Federalist Society were able to walk into that breach and really succeed in the way they have succeeded.
Is there something about progressive thinking that makes it less susceptible to ideological definition than conservative thinking?
It's the right question, Warren, and that's the right point. What is derisively called identity politics or siloing by the Democrats is basically true. It's very hard to hold Democrats, even on the even on the committees, to keep them in line to go in a kind of forceful way toward a candidate. And as Lindsey Graham says in the film, hey, if you want judges, you got to win elections. And you guys didn't win. We did. We're going to have our kind of judges. And in a way, that simple statement says that the Democrats have to figure out a way to do that, to coalesce around at least the issues that a court might deal with, and they just haven't been able to. And a lot of it is because of the diversity and the intellectual elasticity of the Democrats.
You've said that all this starts with the Bork nomination by Ronald Reagan, as far as Mitch McConnell's concerned, but I want to go back a bit to Lyndon Johnson's replacement of Earl Warren, the great civil rights advocate. That was a game changer, too. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point, talking with Michael Kirk, director of Frontline's Supreme Revenge. Now, after the Warren Court's civil rights decisions in the 1960s, Southern politicians were seething. When Warren retired as Chief Justice, LBJ tried to replace him by promoting another liberal justice, his old friend and advisor, Abe Fortas. The Republicans came after Fortas in exactly the same way that Mitch McConnell came after Merrick Garland. So Supreme Revenge has a history.
Well, that's exactly right. In the old days, maybe when we were younger, the court was that place where once people went into that crucible and they closed the door, Earl Warren himself, this, was, a Republican governor of California. Who knew what he'd be like when he was, Chief Justice? And it's been true all the way along. In some cases, people hold to what they are, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for sure. But sometimes there is a kind of, willingness to bargain, and there may be certain things. Look at Kennedy, Powell. They were the so-called swing voters. They were always, kind of up for grabs on a certain kind of issue. You kind of held your nose if you were a Republican or a Democrat, and you let somebody in because there was a kind of balance you were trying to get, and you were all the politics of destruction hadn't quite taken over in the clinches between the Republicans and the Democrats the way they really started to do with Bork. So Bork was the first time that it became more like a campaign than a kind of bargaining session among philosopher kings in the Senate and the White House and et cetera to create a court. By the time you get to Bork, it's on national television. And really, for the first time, people watch the sausage being made. They watch Kennedy take down a guy. They watched the guy himself implode. They watched what we now call the politics of destruction get started by the time Clarence Thomas is there. So it's not all of these moments where justices are elevated or judges are elevated to justice. It's some of them, and it's the ones usually that are seats that really, really matter in a political sense. But the candidates themselves, the justices themselves, have never really been overtly political until we find ourselves with Brett Kavanaugh.
And you make a great point that the earlier controversy, particularly over Earl Warren, was in a much smaller arena. It was just in the Senate where they were having these battles going on. But now, with television, as you say, everybody able to see the sausage making, it's a very different story. Let's look ahead a bit. And if the Federalist Society and the list that has been given to Donald Trump is an indicator, and we now have more and more judges on that list appointed not just to the Supreme Court, but to other courts all over the country as well, district courts and appellate courts. What can we look forward to in terms of the way decisions are made if the Federalist Society gets its way?
Well, so here's a sort of fundamental thing that people told me a lot. So let me preface my answer with this. If you're a politician, you can decide to wage a battle for a policy and get that, enacted. It may last a term or two terms, or not much longer till the politics change in the wind. If you can get a judge, appeals court judges, certainly on the Supreme Court judges, that's a lifetime. That's six terms of a president with most Supreme Court appointments. So that's a battleground that's really important in our society, especially now that we're so divided as a country. So that's part one. Part two, 82, 86 cases a year decided by the United States Supreme Court. A lot, especially when you think of the power of what it means to be decided, but not really. But at the appeals court level, at the district judge level, you're talking about thousands of cases that never make it to the Supreme Court but become essentially law, a precedent-setting law. And if you've populated the appeals courts across the country with Donald Trump and Federalist Society and Mitch McConnell blessed judges, you're going to get their politics for a generation. And, if you and I want to look at the crystal ball and look out for a decade or two, already we know this, between the five justices on the Supreme Court, the 100 or so new appeals court justices and more to come, and not to mention that the district judge level, that's the law of the land for 10 or 20 years.
So in addition to the corporate interests that we talked about earlier, and the ideological interests, which would include abortion, what else are we talking about that the Federalist Society and all of these various judges now who are members of it and on the courts, what do they want to accomplish?
Well, I think there is an idea of a rollback on particularly intrusive, from their point of view, things that we've kind of gotten used to living with. Let's say we all know that abortion is going to be a battleground. It is already a battleground. It is working its way toward the court, however that happens and whenever that happens. Let's be conservative, if you will, and say 3 to 5 years from now, maybe sooner. But take something like affirmative action. I think the Harvard case of affirmative action case and the North Carolina affirmative action cases are on a collision course heading for the court. And this is classic Federalist Society, conservative judgeship territory, heading inevitably to the Supreme Court, where affirmative action, if you like affirmative action, where affirmative action will be imperiled. And certainly, if you don't like it, you can probably wave goodbye to it in the rearview mirror. It's those kind of issues that I think voters and people who are listening to this want to go out and just examine and say, okay, is this a good thing or a bad thing from my point of view?
What about the way these things are covered in the media? As you say, thousands of cases are being decided at lower levels all the time. We don't hear much about them, but they tend to sort of build up over time, and then suddenly, once in a while, they overflow into the U.S. Supreme Court. But otherwise, people don't know much about them. Is this something that ought to be covered more?
Well, I absolutely. Of the many, 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 you're on a that we can share a soapbox for just a second here. As far as I'm concerned,
I was just building the box for you to stand on. Then,
well, you're obviously a master builder. Here we go. So one of the great sad things about the death of the local newspaper, the Denver Post in Denver and much smaller towns, is that two things are not happening. One, local government is no longer being covered. So in the way that even as badly as it might have been covered by Cub reporters somewhere, you were still, at least you knew what was happening with the city council and the community, county commissioners and the police department. All those things are not being covered anymore by newspapers or anything else, by the dying newspaper or anything else. The other end of that, capital A and D, the courts are not being covered basically at all, including the Supreme Court in lots of ways. I spent lots of time with Linda Greenhouse, who I've admired basically all of my reading life.
New York Times, a longtime reporter at the court.
Wonderful, wonderful woman. I've waited a long time in my life to actually make a film where I could interview her, and we did, and we had an amazing time. But, you know, here's Linda saying that when she got the beat, it was because nobody else really wanted it, you know, the United States Supreme Court. And the fact is, it's just, now the courts are just not places where reporters are getting the kind of BuzzFeed headlines that they want if they want to, you know. So there it is. That's my soapbox speech.
Let's look forward to the current presidential campaign. And of course, one of the people that plays a very strong role in your documentary is Joe Biden.
Yes, he does. He's as you know from the film, and as maybe your listeners know, was the bright young man in Washington, chair of the committee when Bork was up. I think at 44, maybe 43, and by the time he's 48, he's in charge of the Clarence Thomas Committee. He is running for president when the Bork hearings are happening. He is discovered plagiarizing a speech from an Irish politician. He then has to admit that he plagiarized in law school and other things. There are many, many questions about how he handled the Anita Hill part of the Thomas hearings. And there is Joe Biden on camera, right in front of you, being the Joe Biden many of us remember from all those years. And what is the impact of all of this? And why did Joe, for example, call Anita Hill on the telephone a month or so ago? What does he think is happening? Does he think these things will follow him on into his run for the presidency? Probably. And so what is he doing about it? I think they're rolling a lot of these things out in advance of getting very close to the real elections so that they can see what happens and let it kind of be served up cold by the time they get back around to debates and other things.
We know about Anita Hill and the conversation that he had with her and how unsatisfied she was with it, saying that it wasn't really an apology, and that's what she demanded. Another person you talked to, in addition to Linda Greenhouse, is Nina Totenberg, who, of course, works for NPR and broke the Anita Hill story. She's very important in your documentary.
She does a wonderful thing, which is that she acts like she talks like she is, which is a real reporter. And she said when she was covering the hearings, this is the Thomas hearings, suddenly kind of out of the blue, Biden makes an announcement. It's an ad hoc announcement, and he says, we're not going to talk about the personal issues that people may be raising about Clarence Thomas. The issues of character are not on the agenda here. And she's sitting there listening to it, and she's thinking, what? Who's raising this? This is completely out of the blue, Joe. What are we doing? As she says, she goes out and kicks some tires, and it doesn't take very long over one weekend to get the name Anita Hill, to call Anita Hill, to talk to Anita Hill. And the explosion that then follows in Washington is the result of what Nina did.
Indication of how the media works when it works.
Exactly. When there used to be people who listened carefully. I mean, I'm not saying everybody, but obviously Nina is a great example of reporters who covered something as complex and complicated as the Supreme Court and the Senate, and know what they were listening for. And when they hear something that feels, out of round, I'll stay with my kick the tires metaphor. And she says, OK, I'm going to act on that and I'm going to do it. And when she did it, there were a lot of reporters in Washington who woke up and jumped all over it as well. And it became the drama we all watched on television at the time.
Back to Robert Bork. You talked to his son.
Yes. One of those wonderful moments where somebody walks in a room and you're about to interview them and you realize it's like the father walking in the room. The physical resemblance is very striking and profound. And I'd seen him in stock footage sitting behind his father at the hearings. He was a reporter for the U.S. News and World Report and a big believer in his dad and a good interview and a guy who watched, you can just imagine if it was your father essentially having his hair lit on fire by a committee right before your eyes and right before the eyes of the country, a father who you think had really earned earned the right to be sitting in that chair, and then suddenly the Democrats in this moment have decided to declare war on him. It was painful for Bork Jr., that's for sure.
Speaking of family connections, you mentioned earlier the Ted Kennedy speech, famous speech with regard to Bork and talking about Bork's America. And then you also talked, of course, to President Obama, who didn't have any family connections. But he was really, after Ted Kennedy, it seems to me, as significant a Democratic spokesperson and person who identified a Democratic politics more than anybody else. And yet, the interview you did with him is just fascinating. He just simply wasn't, or what you heard about him, I should say, was that he just simply wasn't going to turn his attention to this, even though he, of course, was himself an attorney and a constitutional law professor.
If you're a Democrat and you're president of the United States, and you have the constituencies that got you elected and the promises that you made, it's a fascinating, fascinating, and you've promised to be a unifier, not a divider. You're bipartisan to your bones. You really believe you have to do that, and you believe that if you can do all of those things and make that happen, that you can get huge social change underway in America in territories like national or like health care, universal health care for people, and other things, and you face the crushing, the open abyss of the financial collapse right before you, and you've inherited this. You can see why, even though You may know a lot about constitutional law, even though you know he worked for Larry Tribe, maybe the best progressive constitutional law professor in America. You just can't put the political capital to what you need to do. And when Mitch McConnell does his very first revenge moment about Merrick Garland, and you would think that Obama would step up at this moment and forcefully say, all right, here's the kind of liberal justice we think belongs on this court. There were a lot of people on the edges of his administration arguing to him that he go in and bring somebody really tough and forceful before the American people and draw a distinction between what McConnell and the Republicans were doing and what he wanted to do. But instead, Obama decided to pick a choice, Merrick Garland, who is, by all accounts, moderate, middle-of-the-road, bipartisan, going to get along with everybody, going to do it enough so that maybe 8 or 10 Republicans were ready to go with him and tried a little mini-revolt from McConnell. So here's Obama kind of trying to do that kind of a maneuver, go around the edges of McConnell. But a lot of people would say, come on. Garland was never going to be important or forceful enough to help even Hillary Clinton make a strong and forceful argument for her own candidacy that she was going to do something to change the nature of the court, which was already moving in the wrong direction, thanks to McConnell and the Federalist Society.
We're talking about what's often referred to as the third branch of government. Now we have a dispute going on, perhaps a historic one, between the executive branch and the legislative branch. At what point do you think is likely, if it's possible to make predictions, the third branch is going to get involved in this? And given what you know as a result of the research you've done, where do you think it's going?
I mean, it seems almost inevitable that where we're headed, if we're not in a constitutional crisis, we're on our way to one. And that's certainly there's a lot of people that I've talked to in this process and in the process of us making a big film this year about the Mueller report and the impact of the Mueller report. So lots of people I've talked to who have said what we're on now is, if not a constitutional crisis, we're certainly on a collision course. Everything is heading in the direction of the court. That's why a lot of constitutional scholars were very worried about the choice of progressive constitutional scholars were worried about the choice of Kavanaugh because of his relationship in the Bush administration to executive power and decisions about executive power vis-a-vis the war in Iraq and torture and other things. So you have a court that's right now kind of unknown. Is Kavanaugh more moderate than we think? Is Roberts moving to the center? Is he pulling Kagan over there with him? Will the center hold at the Supreme Court if questions of executive power and executive privilege of stopping the president's or the White House counsel from talking, stopping a bar from testifying, not providing documents, even unredacted documents, is that all headed in the direction of the courts? And it sure seems like that's where we're going. And when that happens, the court watchers are going to be watching very closely about what where is Kavanaugh? What do we know about him? We'll all start to win at my side of the press. We'll go deeply into Kavanaugh's background and records about these things, as well as Roberts and others on the court, because it just seems likely, if not absolutely positively going to happen, that we're headed in the direction of a constitutional collision. And if so, what do you do? What if the president doesn't honor it? What if the court finds another way? What are the implications for future presidents? That's the thing about the court that's most interesting. It's not just what happens with Donald Trump and potential impeachment and all of that. It's what do other presidents gain in terms of power from this fight?
And we can talk about these long-term issues and the principles involved and so on, but you have a final moment in the documentary that reminds us that this all comes down ultimately to who happens to be serving where at a given time. You have commentary with regard to Ruth Bader Ginsburg's health and a picture of Mitch McConnell.
Well, yes. I mean, it's his court now. He and the Federalist Society, but I would say even McConnell, for the political maneuvering it took to get Kavanaugh on that court and getting the list to Trump, that is his court. You know, as someone in the film says, you had the Warren court, you had the Berger court, and now you have the McConnell court. And that means that your listeners and the American people need to know a lot more about who Mitch McConnell is.
We have gone far and wide. Our major subject is Supreme Revenge. That is the new PBS Frontline documentary. And Michael Kirk is the director. And Michael, it is a real privilege and a lot of fun to talk with you. And thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody, our engineer Chuck Previtari. Make sure to check out this week's To the Point Climate Change Update. Are the American media failing to give their audiences a sense of urgency about an impending disaster? Should we call it climate emergency or climate crisis? Hit us up on social media. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave us a review. Contact me directly, warren.olney@kcrw.org. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Join us next week.